It's the Matt Bubala Show on 720 WGN. For the last couple of days, I've been reading Somebody to Love, The Life, Death, and Legacy of Freddie Mercury, written by Matt Richards and Mark Langthorne. Mark joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Mark, how are you this morning?
Hey, how are you, Matt? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for jumping on the phone with us. We appreciate it.
What time is it there?
It is 4.09 a.m. here.
Really? Okay. Okay.
It's nice and early. What time is it where you are? It's middle of the afternoon, probably, right?
10.09 in London.
Okay, excellent. How long?
Beautiful sunny day.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, it's supposed to snow here this weekend, so you enjoy that good weather while you got it, Mark.
Thanks, Matt.
So how long, this is such an in-depth book with a lot of research. How long did it take you and Matt to finish this book? Is this a couple-year process at least?
It is, yeah. You know, from the initial idea through to publication, about 2.5 years.
It not only tells the story of Freddie Mercury very in-depth, but also tells the story of HIV and AIDS, and you trace the history of that along the way, as well as the forming of Queen and everything else that went along in Freddie's life. It's very incredibly in-depth. And for those of us who, you know, I was born in 71, so Queen was pretty established by the time I was really coming of age and getting into music. So Freddie Mercury has been very mysterious to me. So this is a wonderful book to really learn about the man and who he was and what he went through in life. And I just got the book yesterday, so I've been, you know, reading through it as fast as I can. But you need some time for this book. Tell us a little bit about Freddie starting out, because it's a surprising upbringing. You know, Freddie Mercury was such a flamboyant guy on stage, to read that he was actually shy, and this was a persona that he was really able to reveal on stage, and as he got older and more comfortable with himself, is surprising to me to hear that he was, you know, really raised in a conservative family religiously and went to boarding school and all of these things. Maybe it shouldn't be surprising that, the, you know, kids that maybe grow up in a more of a repressed household than express themselves later in life, but I was shocked to read, you know, about Freddie's upbringing.
I think, you know, I think it's right. He was brought up under a religion called Zoroastrian, and raised in Zanzibar, on the eastern side of the African continent. He had a very strict upbringing and was sent to 3,000 miles to boarding school as a boy, away from his family. So, you know, if you had this strict upbringing, conservative parents, and then abandonment issues, you start to get a melee of a complex person who is not at odds with himself, that feels a need to express himself outside of that.
He went to boarding school for 9 years, starting at the age of 7, which is amazing. And you talk about abandonment issues, but in the few interviews that he really talked about it, he made it sound like it was a positive experience, right? That he, you know, had to learn self-discipline and all the things that go along with being on your own.
You know, it's true. He talks about that self-discipline, which he could transpose into discipline in later life. But he talks, other than that, he talks very rarely about being Indian, about being raised in Zanzibar. He prefers much more to be addressed as Persian, which I think, you know, sounds much more romantic. But it almost is in denial in his 18. He refused to talk about very much of his childhood.
He really had such stage presence. He was such an amazing performer. To read that, you know, when the members of Queen were first starting out, Freddie wasn't a part of any of their bands. He was kind of in the background. He knew the guys. He knew Brian May. He knew Roger Taylor for a long time before he ever performed with them. They were in one band. He kind of was a hanger-on. He ends up in another band and several bands before they all finally get together. How much of that development of him not being with those guys at first do you think helped him become who he was as a performer?
Look, he wanted to be a singer, and he could see these guys that he hung out with trying, making attempts to form groups, seeing singers come and go, and really pushing himself to the front, really wanting to be part of this, elbowing at some point his way into working with them until And they influenced him at that early stage. The horror that they may have got a record deal with a different singer, you know, really upset him. And so it's important that he kind of pushed his way through. I have to say, I have to jump in there, Matt, and say, you've actually read the book. I do a lot of interviews, and these are good questions. But
no, I understand. It's not. I hate to just ask the questions that the PR people said to ask. Well, no, I really want to hear about some of this stuff because, you know, also to read about his sexuality. You know that Freddie was gay and he was extremely flamboyant in his persona, but. You know, the name Queen, and I hadn't thought too much about it over the years, but you're right that when he was not in the band yet, just hanging out with the guys, and he was his flamboyant self whenever they saw him, that they jokingly called him the old Queen. And he came up with the title of the band, and he said he knew full well the implications, but also thought it was very regal and very mysterious. And it was at a time that, you know, Mick Jagger and David Bowie had maybe made openings to you could be a little more flamboyant in public, and I'm sure Elton John as well when he came along. But how did Freddie's sexuality play into the dynamics of the band? Did the band have a tough time, the other straight guys in the band, handling Freddie?
Look, I think it was the 70s, and, you know, a lot of people were bisexual, per se, which Bowie and Mark Bolan were bisexual, but of course they weren't. Freddie was bisexual, but he wasn't really. You know, so Bolan and Bowie were straight. They could toy with bisexuality because they could go back to their straight lives. Freddie, if you're gay in the 70s, you're bisexual to disguise being gay. It was better to be bisexual than gay. It was a safer place. And so the rest of the group, much like me and a lot of people I know, just assumed he was flamboyant. You know, he had a girlfriend. He had several girlfriends. You know, he had a woman he claimed to love. You try not to come to the table making the assumption that somebody's gay just because they're flamboyant.
Yeah.
But at the end, you know, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, maybe it's just a duck.
Well, and it sounds like Freddie was maybe confused too, because you interview women that he loved and who loved him, who, you know, felt, you know, there was a woman early in the book who was dating him quite a bit, and she noticed that he took quite an interest in her gay friends. And when she broke up with him, he was kind of, it sounds like, confused by that. Like, maybe he was, I imagine it has to be tough for him to have maybe come to terms with his own sexuality because of his upbringing, because of his parents, because of the religion aspects of it, that maybe, is it something he really struggled with in his early part of his life?
I think everybody, you know, the majority of gay people in the 70s, whether in Europe, perhaps less so, but certainly in America as well, you know, it was not, it was a homophobic place. It was very difficult. There was a great deal of shame attached to it. It was only made legal at the end of the 60s in Britain. You know, the gays that you had were stereotyped, effeminate, clownish, comical gays on television. There was nothing real to identify with for a gay man. And so it became very quickly not just about Freddie, it became very quickly about the industry of Queen. And, you know, if at any point he had considered coming out, he would have jeopardized not only the group, but all the people that employed, all the people who had faith in him. And it was a career killer. You know, even today, and we live in much more liberal times,
yeah.
There are very few gay successful singers. You know, America as well as Europe, we still struggle with it a great deal. We like to think we don't. But there is still that prejudice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that not only is there prejudice, but I think there's fear when it comes to marketing. And, you know, it's still big corporations a lot of times pushing these singers. And they think about who's going to buy the albums and who's going to buy the music. And they want to cater to whatever they think that crowd is.
It's not just music. It's the film industry.
Sure, sure.
You know, the TV industry. You know, there are superstars that don't feel comfortable coming out even today. That, oh, it's a I mean, they're the worst kept secrets for some. But they just won't say it because it jeopardizes their career.
You also had a really interesting tidbit about Brian May, who I know very little about, but that he and his father, he was studying, what was he studying, like physics? He must have been brilliant, and his father was it physics or a physicist, his father?
A physicist and an astronomer.
And Brian was kind of studying the same stuff, so he must have been, or is very smart. He couldn't afford a Fender Stratocaster, so he and his father built his own first guitar. And it wasn't just some piece of junk.
As you do.
Yeah, as you do. Yeah, so we just built the guitar in the garage. We whipped it out in the weekend.
I think that scientific aspect of Brian May, and also to a degree, Roger, all three of them were very qualified and not particularly in the arts, but they brought a certain technicality and structure to the songwriting later on, which I think kept Freddie's flamboyance grounded in the songwriting.
We're speaking with Mark Langthorne. He, along with Matt Richards, have written the book, The Life, Death, and Legacy of Freddie Mercury. The title is Somebody to Love. It's really fascinating. I want to get into a little bit of Once Queen Actually Gets Going, because that's the part of the book I've gotten to. We'll talk a little more with Mark Langthorne next here on 720 WGN. Matt Buvala with you here, 720 WGN. The book Somebody to Love is authored by Matt Richards and Mark Langthorne. Mark is on the phone with us live from London this morning, chatting about Freddie Mercury and Queen. So when Queen first comes together, these guys had been in several bands, they'd known each other for a while. When they finally come together, Mark, is it success right away, or do they struggle to find their identity and to find fans?
They struggle to find a record label. They enter into a deal which is unsuccessful. But serendipity has it that David Bowie is not available for a program. It's a very popular TV program that we have here called Top of the Pops. And they were given a last-minute opportunity to perform a track called The Seven Seas of Rye. And that changed everything here. It went immediately top 10, and it changed overnight for them.
What was the song that went immediately top 10?
Seven Seas of Rye.
And that's a song that, I mean, maybe just because I wasn't on Queen from the beginning and just more greatest hits and later in life, that's not a song I even know. I don't think that's one that's certainly a radio staple here. Maybe it is over there, is it?
It was released in the U.S. and also became a minor hit in the U.S., but It allowed them to get their foot in the door.
Yeah. When do they break through and become the Queen that we know as, like, really one of the greatest rock bands of all time?
Oh, everything changed with Bohemian Rhapsody. So it was over 6 minutes long. Everybody knows the song.
Sure. Yeah.
It's probably encompasses every Queen song you really need in one song.
Yeah.
It tells you everything about the group. It changed everything. The radio stations here, a particular DJ picked it up. He played it 14 times in one day. The public went crazy. Due to their schedule, they were not able to perform on this popular TV show, so they made a video, quite an extraordinary video for the time, which propelled it to number one for 9 weeks. And then in the U.S., it became a huge hit, too.
And it's really...
It wouldn't be as big as it would later on with Mike Myers' Wayne's World, which would once again reignite it in the U.S.
Yeah.
But first time round, it was a big hit.
Yeah, and it's a song that's probably been remade in pop culture more than most other songs, I would say, because not only Mike Myers, but the Muppets, who were quite a hit here, did a Bohemian Rhapsody that you find online. And it's one of those songs that whether you know Queen or not, you probably know the song Bohemian Rhapsody. It's one of those songs that's just an indelible piece of rock and roll history.
Absolutely. It confounds the critics. It's three segments present at first the ballad section, followed by the operatic section, and then the rock section at the end. So you have three structures to it. As I said earlier, its running time defied everyone. We spoke to the man, John Reed, their manager at the time. He had doubts about it. Of course, Elton John expressed doubts about it when he thought his opinion. But this DJ picked it up, and it took off after that.
Yeah, it's amazing that you never know what's truly going to strike people's fancy, and sometimes artists have to be allowed to be artists and break new ground. And they, you know, that song is really a rock opera unto itself. It didn't require a whole album. That song is just a story all on its own, isn't it?
I do. I think there's a lot of conjecture as to the meaning of it, and there is a part in the book where we look at the possible meanings of it. As perhaps Freddie trying to tell us that he is gay through the song and why. So that was quite an interesting exercise to do.
The song We Are the Champions and We Will Rock You has become, that's also another one that was just, you know, taken over by sport. Did they ever express frustration with that song? I wonder if, like...
No, not at all. He thought of English football, soccer. Soccer?
Thank you for Americanizing that for us.
Yeah, exactly. He thought of the fans and their chanting when they came up with the chorus of it.
Really? Okay, so it embraced.
So they were very happy. Freddie and Queen were very happy to be populist. They were very happy to reach out to large numbers of people. They were never really interested in critical success.
At the very beginning of the book, you talk about Freddie's last days, and I know I haven't gotten, you know, I have a long way to go still in the book to get through it all, but you talk about him towards...
I'm sorry, listeners, he hasn't read the book.
I'm getting there. But you talk about his end days and the struggles he had. Was he at peace at the end? Was he happy with life and his career and where he had been? He went through so many struggles, you know, in his younger days with sexuality and finding acceptance in a band and becoming who he wanted to become, although undoubtedly frustrated with being sick and being cut short. Had he found peace?
Yeah, I think probably at the very end you find peace in surrender. I think we begin the book 3 weeks before his death, in which he's chosen to stop any kinds of medication. I think at that point you accept the end is inevitable, and you withdraw from the medical advisors around you and get on with dying. So, and I don't want in any way for the listener to think that I hope it's not a depressing book. You know, it's a... In truth, I didn't know a great deal about AIDS, but I knew that Freddie was the poster boy for it, from our point of view, very much as Rock Hudson was in the US.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that when we lost Freddie, everybody had then lost somebody they knew who had AIDS, and that was really important. And so I wanted to link the story of this terrible disease to a person who we were all very familiar with. And I wanted Queen fans not to get a medical book, and I knew that the majority of people won't pick up a book about AIDS, but I thought the AIDS element was an interesting story to tell, and Freddie's personal struggle with the times and with the disease weaved in, I thought, very well to the story.
Yeah, it really does, and you know, it is fascinating to learn about it. Let me just ask you one last question then. In England, when Freddie died, as you said, you know, a disease that's so understood and maybe controversial because of, you know, a lack of acceptance of homosexuality, certainly at the time when AIDS became full-blown. You mentioned that, you know, now everybody knew somebody. Did that help change public perception and maybe empathy towards people suffering from HIV in England?
It completely changed everything. It loosened the grip that the tabloids had on their homophobia. It made people look and evaluate the disease. It raised enormous amounts of funds and awareness. The legacy that he left was far greater than he could have expected, in much the same way that Rock Hudson with Liz Taylor changed the entire face of AIDS and the people who suffered from it. I think it's an important story to keep to document.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Rock Hudson because that was the first major news story here in the U.S. really of a famous person with AIDS, and then I guess our second one would have been Magic Johnson coming out as HIV positive, and he's still surviving and very healthy today.
I think Rock was the most shocking for everybody. It was so early on. It was 1985.
Yeah.
He had no intention of telling the world. He'd made preparations for his death in secrecy from claiming it would be cancer. But unfortunately, he collapsed in Paris and the hospital refused to take him unless he told the world. So, but then having accepted that, he found the response, the love, the support almost overwhelming, and set up the foundation with Liz Taylor, which transformed the disease.
Yeah. It's a great book. It's called Somebody to Love, The Life, Death, and Legacy of Freddie Mercury, Matt Richards, and Mark Langthorne. Mark, I'm going to keep reading, and I'd love to have you back on the show again sometime down the road, because I think there's a lot more to talk about here.
It's been a pleasure. It really has been a pleasure, and I want to thank you for taking the time. And is it time for you to go home now, or are you just starting?
We got a half hour left, and then I get to kick off for the weekend.
And then you go to bed.
And then I go to bed for a little while, yes.
Listen, guys, have a great time. Have a great weekend to your listeners.
Thank you so much, Mark. We'll talk to you again sometime soon. Again, Somebody to Love, The Life, Death, and Legacy of Freddie Mercury. It's out in hardback now.